What are the advantages of cooperative buying and marketing? How have many farmers solved the machinery shortage? Why is soil erosion known as public enemy number one? These and other timely topics will be presented at this time by the Columbia Country Journal with editor Chuck Worcester.
Farm people are naturally pretty handy at making on-the-spot machinery repairs with that proverbial shingle nail and baling wire. But on a good many farms of the country, real inventive ingenuity shows up in everything from a trick latch on a barn door to a complete homemade tractor rebuilt from an old truck. To bring you a report on some of these farm-made machines and gadgets, today Country Journal visits one of the leading county fairs of the country, Mahoning County, Ohio, as we take you now to station WKBN in Youngstown, Stuart Wilson reporting.
1946 marks the 100th anniversary of the founding of Mahoning County, Ohio. And the folks in this section felt that one of the best ways to celebrate this centennial would be to have the biggest county fair in the country. And that's just what they've done. This year's fair is a 10-day event which started last Saturday and will run through Labor Day. There are all the regular features you'd expect at a county fair. Excellent livestock, 4-H club, and grange exhibits displaying the crops and handiwork of the farm folks in this area. WKBN has set up a huge auditorium tent. There are right now about 400 people in here watching this broadcast. Last year's attendance at this fair went well over the 100,000 mark. And this year it's expected to go considerably higher, so you can get some idea of the size of the thing. One of the most interesting features here at the fair has been a unique contest conducted by WKBN's farm department. We've been running a competition to find the best homemade farm tractor in this area. And you'd be amazed at the excellence of some of the machines which were entered. Some of them look very much like factory-built models. Others seem to be just what they are. Tractors constructed from an assortment of odds and ends of old automobiles, trucks, and farm machinery. The only limit to the effectiveness of these tractors is the ingenuity and craftsmanship of the builder. The 17 entries in the contest were from 4 different counties and 2 states, all within easy driving distance, of course, of the fairgrounds. One of the tractors was the darndest contraption you've ever seen. The engine was from an old Model T Ford. The rear wheels from a manure spreader mounted on the rear axle of an ancient truck. The rest of the rig was made up of cast-off chains, gears, cable, and other assorted junk. All in all, it was one of the strangest-looking machines I've ever seen. But close examination showed that the builder had used a great deal of thought in setting up a machine that could do a variety of farm work with a minimum of effort on the part of the driver. Front wheels were set off to one side so that the operator could see the row in cultivating. All the raising and lowering of the implements fastened to the tractor was accomplished by a clever mechanical lift powered by the engine. Another of the entries was an enormous machine using the engine and a good many parts from a big transcontinental bus. Construction had been kept quite simple but strong. The effect was one of enormous power. The judging of the contest was no simple matter because there were so many excellent homemade tractors entered. The race for first and second places was particularly close, with W.I. Kimball of East Lewistown, Ohio, barely nosing out Bert Schaefer of Salem. Both the machines looked a good deal like factory-built jobs and reflected careful planning, good craftsmanship, and real farm utility. The winning tractor is parked right down here in front of the stage from which we're broadcasting. Now, suppose we talk a bit about it with W.I. Kimball, the man who constructed the tractor. Mr. Kimball, how did you happen to build the tractor in the first place?
Well, I was purchasing the farm, and, you know, the farms cost money, tractors cost money, and my job was a mechanic, so I decided I'd build my own. After all, I wanted something just a little bit different that would still do the job.
In other words, you wanted to incorporate your own ideas about what a tractor
That's right.
should be.
Huh? Well, see what you can do.
Where did you do the work?
1940.
Oh, that was the time you did it. So you've been using it then for about 6 years, have you?
I've been using it about 6 years.
Well, now, again, to get back to that other question, where did you build it?
I built it in a small building that I assembled back of the house that I eventually used for a chicken coop.
Well, now, wasn't that kind of small to get the tractor
well,
in and out?
Well, it was kind of small, but after I got it built, I took the end out and to get the tractor out.
In other words, you almost had to tear down the building to get the tractor out of there.
I almost had to tear it down, and I started working from there, and it's been working ever since.
Well, now, how about the cost of this tractor?
Well, around the $460 extra money paid out besides the labor.
That's plus your own labor.
That's
huh?
right.
Well, now, how much acreage are you farming with the tractor right now?
Why, 120 acres this year, but before that, 60.
So that it really, then, is in use.
Is that right? Use, that's right.
And it is a very fine tractor, incorporates hydraulic lift on the implement, and also had to find power takeoff for driving such implements as a combine or a pickup baler or the things that we're using around farms now because of the labor shortage. Well, thanks very much then, Mr. Kimball.
Thank you.
Let's have a big hand from the crowd here for Mr. Kimball. You know, the scarcity of tractors during the war caused a good many farmers to build their own or go without. And never let it be said that the American farmer ever goes without something he needs just because he can't buy it. Around almost every farm, there's usually enough spare and junk machinery parts so the resourceful farmer can manage to put together almost anything he wants. But it certainly seems as though the homemade farm tractor is here to stay. This is Stuart Wilson speaking from the stage of WKBN's auditorium tent at the Mahoning County Centennial Fair at Canfield, Ohio. Country Journal returns now to Chuck Worcester in Washington.
There's good reason why soil erosion has become public enemy number one to the farmers of the country. 1/4 of all our cultivated land has been ruined beyond repair. Half of it is in need of immediate conservation attention. And most of the rest of it is constantly in danger of damage from erosion. For a report on the fight against erosion and other soil damage in the Upper Mississippi Valley area, Country Journal takes you now to station WCCO in Minneapolis, Larry Haig reporting.
It's estimated that more than half of the best grade farmland in the United States is located in Iowa, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Illinois. And so great a heritage is worth preserving. How has this farmland been used in the past? And how can it be used in the future? Well, these are some of the problems being studied at the Upper Mississippi Soil and Water Conservation Experiment Station at La Crosse, Wisconsin. The experiment station is located on a typical farm in southwestern Wisconsin in La Crosse County, high up on the bluffs overlooking the Mississippi River and the city of La Crosse. Here, the state and federal workers are observing the action of the rains in washing away that precious topsoil. Back in 1932, state and federal workers in soil conservation held a meeting at La Crosse. And these men spent considerable time going over the farms in that area. And they observed that a few of the farmers had developed patterns of farming that seemed to control soil erosion with strip cropping, contour fields, and terracing. And they also found that most of the farmers in that area desired help in solving the problems of soil erosion. In order to find out how soil erosion actually worked, the state of Wisconsin purchased a farm near La Crosse. And on it, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, together with the University of Wisconsin, have been measuring the soil and water losses on small experimental plots. These plots, most of them about 1/100th of an acre in size, are on a 16% slope. A 16% slope is one having a vertical drop of 16 feet for each 100 feet on the horizontal. And this is no steeper than the ordinary field in many of the farms in this area. The plots are separated by metal strips, and at the foot of each plot is a basin which catches the soil washed off during each rain. And this soil is weighed and measured. These plots are planted to different crops, some to corn, some to grain, and others are summer fallow. The soil losses on these plots are compared with those seeded to grass and hay crops. Now along the Mississippi River in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois, and Iowa are almost 18 million acres of land that compare with these experimental plots. And farmers who live on this land can assume that the findings at this experimental farm are similar to what is happening on their own land if proper soil conservation is not practiced. And here's what they've found out about soil losses. Each season, 70 to 80% of the soil loss occurs during 3 or 4 rainstorms. Light rains cause very little erosion, but rainfalls of 1.5 inches or better in 30 minutes cause thousands of tons of topsoil to be washed away. For instance, during one rain, corn plots at the station lost 70 tons of soil per acre, and that's equivalent to almost 1/2 inch of topsoil. 15 storms in 5 years took 74% of the topsoil from plots planted to corn. The loss on plots in summer fallow was the greatest, close to 100 tons of soil per acre. In the plots planted to grass and hay crops, the most severe rainstorms in the last 5 years hasn't resulted in a soil loss exceeding 1.5 tons per acre. Now, farmers along the Mississippi Valley have become extremely interested in these soil conservation projects, not because it's a fad or a style, but out of real necessity. For if they don't practice soil conservation, their farms will be washed away. And today, through the hill country along the Mississippi, you'll see prosperous-looking farms. Farms that are producing more crops per acre than 10 years ago, all because of soil conservation. It's a battle with the elements to keep the farms from washing down into the Mississippi, but the farmers are winning that fight, and the evidence of the success is so well shown at the Upper Mississippi Soil Conservation Experiment Station at La Crosse, Wisconsin. And now this is Larry Haig in Minneapolis. The Country Journal returns now to Chuck Worcester in Washington.
This past week, representatives of leading farm supply and marketing cooperatives throughout the country have been attending the 18th annual meeting of the American Institute of Cooperation at Purdue University in Indiana. Today, it's a pleasure to have Dr. Raymond W. Miller, president of the Institute, as our Country Journal guest to give us the highlights of the meeting and explain the significance of cooperatives in the farm marketing and supply picture. For Dr. Miller's report, we take you to station WBBM in Chicago.
The American Institute of Cooperation yesterday completed its 18th annual session on the campus of a college. This year's session was held at Purdue University, Lafayette, Indiana. The last was in 1942. The Institute is a fact-finding and disseminating organization interested in the sociological, legal, economic, and accounting phases of cooperative corporations operating in the field of purchasing and or marketing the supplies or products of primary agricultural producers. It has as its members a cross-section of the general and cooperative farm organizations of the United States. On its board of trustees are leaders from agricultural groups, as well as educators, attorneys, and editors interested in the part that farm cooperatives may perform in building and preserving a democratic way of life. Farm cooperatives are non-profit, private enterprises. They are democracy in corporate form. They enable the individual farmer to utilize the benefits of corporate structures in securing supplies or marketing products together with his neighbor. They are a yardstick in the field of business, and through their democratic principles, they aim to help stabilize rural America by preserving the American farmer rather than having become a member of the peon or peasant class, which is all too often the lot of the primary producer of agricultural products throughout the world, who sells at wholesale and buys at retail. They exist side by side with their corporate partners in the free enterprise system, the profit corporation. By using them, farmers make a profit with their neighbors rather than from their neighbors. The sessions at Purdue were attended by some 2,000 farm leaders from every part of the United States, with visitors from about a dozen foreign countries. None were delegates. All came who were interested in the farm cooperatives as a part of an integrated national economy. The sessions were addressed by over 200 speakers, including such men as Dr. Edwin G. Norse, Vice President of the Brookings Institute, and recently appointed Chairman of the Economic Advisory Council, Chester C. Davis, Chairman of the President's Famine Emergency Committee, and Dr. William Myers of the same committee, and Mr. E.G. Berland, Deputy Executive Director of CARE, Cooperative for American Remittances to Europe, Incorporated. These men addressed the sessions in regard to the world distribution of food and the part that cooperatives might perform in these international emergencies. The Institute passes no resolutions. Its aim is to bring about a better understanding by farm cooperative leaders of those educational principles whereby they might guide cooperative corporations to become of increasing service to members and patrons alike, and to the nation as a whole in the interests of general welfare. James W. Sells of the Methodist Church, Atlanta, Georgia. Monsignor M. M. Cody of the Catholic Church from Antigonish, Nova Scotia. Mr. Clyde Edmonds from the General Welfare Board of the Mormon Church, Salt Lake City, Utah. And Mrs. Samuel I. Roseman, New York, of the Jewish Faith, presented papers on the general subject of religion and cooperatives. The next annual general conference session of the Institute will be held August 25th to 29, 1947, on the campus of the Colorado State Agricultural College, Fort Collins, Colorado.
You have just heard Dr. Raymond W. Miller, president of the American Institute of Cooperation. Country Journal returns now to Chuck Wooster in Washington.
Housewives spend hundreds of dollars and many hours every year trying to get rid of 1,000 varieties of bugs. But not before the bugs have caused a lot of damage to clothing, furnishings, and food. DDT and other new insecticides have come a long way in the battle against household insects. There's a lot to be learned yet, though. Today, Country Journal presents a report on how these insecticides work, what care can be taken to save millions of dollars every year. For that report, here's our home editor, Mary Burnham.
Right now is the time of year when moth damage is brought to homemakers' attention as they get ready to take blankets and winter clothes out of storage and put away summer things. I think moths cause about the biggest headaches of any insect because you never know where they're working until the damage is done.
I know holes just suddenly turn up in drapes, upholstering, and rugs. What can be done to avoid this?
DDT is the best single insecticide that's been found so far. It's effective against most moths, flies, mosquitoes, and gnats. A 5% spray or dust of DDT is the minimum strength if it's to be used alone. And thorough spraying of DDT throughout the house, including closets and chests, will get most flying insects. But to be sure, it's a good idea to dust the powder in cracks, behind baseboards, under quarter rounds, and in all sorts of out-of-the-way places like that, where bugs develop and hide, and then crawl out to do their damage.
How about fly sprays that contain DDT and are supposed to be effective for killing such insects?
Many of them are good if they're used properly. DDT works slowly. A fly spray which contains pyrethrum for quick knockdown and a small amount of DDT, say 1 to 3%, is fine for killing insects. But it won't have the lasting effect that the stronger DDT sprays and dust do have.
You haven't mentioned a number of other pests, Mary, like silverfish, roaches, bedbugs, ants, carpet beetles. They bother a lot of different things.
A variety of treatments can be used on them, too. But careful and thorough use of both DDT spray and powder will get rid of silverfish, roaches, bedbugs, and beetles. It takes quite a lot, though. That's why some folks have been disappointed with their results.
Incidentally, is DDT dangerous to use?
Not so much as a lot of the poisons we've used before. There's no danger with the dust unless you eat it. And you know you don't need to close up the house to use DDT spray like you do fly spray. The only possible danger there is if you leave spray which has an oil base on your skin. And washing is all that's necessary to get rid of that.
Well, that should relieve a lot of people's minds. You almost sound like DDT is a cure-all. Are there any bugs it doesn't kill?
Yes, a few. And there's still a lot of work to be done, finding better ways to use DDT, testing new insecticides, and learning whether the bugs will like a lot of these new fabrics we're getting.
Well, will it pay to try DDT?
Yes, because it's simpler and just as economical as if anything. If it doesn't work, the old plan of poison baits is reliable, but of course it's more trouble. Tartar emetic and grease or sodium arsenate and sugar are good for ants, of course. The familiar sodium fluoride is good for silverfish, even better than DDT. And common fly spray is still the most effective weapon against spiders. But every day or so, we hear of a new insecticide. A regular alphabet of letters and figures. DFDT, 666, 662, and many others. Someday, we may have ways to get rid of all kinds of bugs.
Well, I understand the latest insecticides that's given a rating as good or even better than DDT is the Navy's new product called 448. It acts in much the same way as DDT, that is, the insects need only to touch it to be poisoned, and it works equally well on all insects. DDT, you know, doesn't seem to bother some bugs. Also, 448 not only kills, but also repels insects. And best of all, the new 448 is supposed to be completely harmless to man and animals. Of course, DDT has always been considered dangerous in excessive amounts. Well, the business of farming in this country has gone through quite a number of startling, some of them amusing, developments in recent years. The fact that not so long ago it took 9 farmers to feed themselves and one additional city family, while today one farmer raises enough to supply his own and 7 more city families with more and better food, that's typical of the changes taking place in American agriculture. Some of these changes are leaving behind a colorful history that'll never be repeated, leaving also a bit of rural sentiment that won't be erased until present-day old-timers on the farm have passed on to leave a new generation of farmers who don't remember much about those good old days, as they are so often called. Take, for example, that one-time cornerstone of farm field work, affectionately called the Missouri Mule. Today, Country Journal brings you the story of this picturesque draft animal, once a mainstay, but now fast disappearing from the farm scene. For a first-hand account of what's happening to those tough old mules that once made Missouri famous, Here's a report direct from Ted Magner, Director of Farm Activities for Station KMOX in St. Louis.
St. Louis is the place where Missouri's leadership as a mule state was recognized internationally at a mule show held way back in 1904. It was then and there that the phrase Missouri mule was coined and became known throughout the world. Perhaps the mule has no pride of ancestry and no hope for posterity, since it is a hybrid, a cross between a donkey and a horse, but its breeding is just as important as that of purebred livestock. George Washington gets the credit for being the first mule breeder in the United States. He got his start when General Lafayette received a shipment from the King of Spain in 1785. In Missouri, the first mules made their appearance about 1850. But as the South was coming into its own as a cotton-producing area, the mule business grew by leaps and bounds. There's plenty of reason why mules soon became the number one choice among work animals on the farm. The mule is more sure-footed, more able to look out for himself, and can get by on smaller amounts of cheaper feed than the horse. He uses more of his energy for work, learns how to avoid hard work or undesirable conditions, is thicker skinned, he'll never hurt himself in a runaway, and is a master at avoiding muddy places or puddles of water in the road. On the other hand, though, the mule's comparatively small, hard feed don't serve him so well in plowed fields or in hard, smooth city streets. He has a habit of pushing directly forward against the collar instead of crouching and lifting as the horse does. And while these characteristics make the horse more desirable for heavier jobs, the mule's famous trickery and stubbornness also makes him less of a pleasure to drive. Mules are almost synonymous with Missouri. The state has supplied some 4,000 a year to the sugarcane regions of Louisiana and the heavy black dirt land of Texas. A majority of this country's best-known mule breeders are located in Missouri. And while in actual mule numbers, we're outranked by eight other states, the mule business continues to center right around here. What's happening to the mule business, you say? Well, the old-timers say the farmer of today is going machine mad. Old Dobbin and his half-sister Maud the Mule are being replaced by the tractor. Many of them, no doubt, the homemade kind described by Stuart Wilson just a few moments ago. Back in 1925, Missouri had about as many mules as she ever did, about 370,000. That year, there were close to 6 million in the whole country. In 20 years, quoting last year's figures, Missouri's mule numbers were cut by some 60% to barely 170,000, and the national total cut just about in half. But our Missouri mule breeders aren't worried. Louis M. Monsees, better known as Colonel in the Show Me State, only recently sold one of his best jacks for a nice round figure of $5,000, the highest price ever paid in the business. The Colonel and other famous mule breeders of the state figure the mule business is here to stay for many more good years, in spite of the inroads of man-made machines. And that's the report from Ted Magner, Farm Director for Station KMOX in St. Louis.
Next week, our Country Journal reports from around the country will include the story of new uses for wood products, how the treatment and adaptation of different types of wood material have opened up whole new fields in the lumber industry. From Chicago, Creighton Scott will review the farm crop outlook in the Middle West with comments on fall weather prospects. The next few weeks are the most important of the year to farmers who hope a killing frost will hold off long enough to allow full maturity of the record corn crop. Last year, you know, an early freeze cut the crop short by 300 million bushels in feeding value and was the main single reason for the world food grain shortage and famine that we've heard so much about in recent months. There'll be a report on UNRWA efforts to relieve that famine from Tanahana in New York. It's time now for local and regional farm news. Good rains fell in almost all parts of the country east of the Rockies this past week. Some of the heaviest fell right where they were needed most, in the parched areas of the Southwest, where the week's total amounted to more than 5 inches in some places. The rainfall was a little late to help much on the corn crop or sorghum that was too far matured to show any late improvement, but the moisture was just in time to permit full-speed fall plowing to get underway, getting ready for fall wheat planting operations. In the Gulf Coast region of Texas, plans are underway for winter vegetable production there. For a detailed review of farm conditions in that area, here is a report direct from George Reisner, farm director at station KTRH, Houston.
Crop conditions in the Gulf Coast of Texas run from good to very poor this year. First, in the way of foodstuffs, the farmers are in the best position they have been at any time during the war years. One of the feeds which have carried the cattle through the feed shortage is the abundant pasture. For 5 years, there have been ideal pasture grasses, and now, with the new improved pastures, the condition has even improved. Matagorda County alone has improved 57 pastures according to the best methods found by the Texas Angleton Experiment Station. The carrying capacity of these improved pastures is about 1 cow per acre, with some using as many as 4 animals per acre. The Gulf Coast region of Texas has the largest number of animals per acre of any section in the United States. The grain sorghum harvest, which is almost finished, is by far the largest and the best ever recorded. It's a pretty sight to drive down the road and see the pretty uniform fields of yellow milo grain, too. Some fields of milo contained as much as 1,000 acres. As well as having a record harvest, a high price was received, with prices going as high as $3.50 per 100 before the break came, which sent the prices of milo downward. This year's crop is being harvested almost 100% by combine, which has been a great help due to the labor shortage. Rice farmers who have had trouble from time to time, they were ready to plant until now, have many tough problems ahead of them. First, the wet weather at planting time made it hard to get the crop planted, and much of the rice was planted in a seed bed that was not properly prepared. The grass and weeds will reduce the yield as well as the weed seeds will reduce the quality of grain harvested. Some rice, which was planted real late, will run into trouble from late harvesting as the Gulf Coast usually has a wet fall. Now, if this happens, it'll be hard to harvest as most of the crop is now being harvested by combines. Another trouble that will arise is the damage done by wild ducks and late planting of rice. In many sections, the summer ducks are already doing damage. The winter duck will start arriving in September when a very small part of the rice crop will have been harvested this year. Early plantings of rice is now being harvested, but in most cases, the farmers are not selling and are holding out for OPA increases in the ceiling price. In most sections of the region, the cotton crop will be one of the poorest ever recorded. Early rains made it almost impossible to get the seed in the ground. Then after the seed was up, continuous rains made it almost impossible to get the cotton chopped and cultivated. In one section, one could see as many as 1,000 acres of cotton that would not be harvested because of grass which overtook the crop. Even where the grass was finally cleaned, the continuous rains made such an ideal weather for boll weevils that the yield will be very low. The cotton crop this year will be the most expensive crop ever harvested because of the amount of grass from wet weather causing tremendous amount of labor cost. The cost of getting an excess of $2 per 100 for picking. This will make the cost of picking one bale of cotton in excess of $30. The farmers in this section have not as yet gone in for mechanical cotton pickers. Local vegetables going to market now consist mainly of eggplants, okra, sweet peppers, black-eyed peas, mustard greens, watermelons, and kefir pears. Fall planting will start as soon as the first good rain. And that's the report direct from George Reisner of station KTRH in Houston, Texas.
Here in Washington, the Department of Agriculture's announcement that new price ceilings on livestock, and therefore on meat, will be noticeably higher than they were when the previous ceilings went off just 2 months ago, seemed to surprise most everyone, including the OPA. Evidently, most reporters and officials had forgotten that the new price control law gave the Secretary of Agriculture a pretty free hand in determining price levels on farm products kept under control. Secretary Anderson's argument in favor of the higher price level was based on the need for encouraging meat production. Most farm leaders, however, feel the record feed grain crop in prospect, with the reasonable feed prices that go hand in hand with a big supply, will be encouragement enough to livestock producers.
You've been listening to the Columbia Country Journal with editor Chuck Worcester. Today's Country Journal featured reports from Ted Magner in St. Louis describing the history of the Missouri mule, from Stuart Wilson in Youngstown, Ohio, telling how farm people have built homemade machinery, and from George Reisner in Houston, Texas, reviewing crop conditions in that part of the country. Larry Haig in Minneapolis described soil conservation activities in the upper Mississippi Valley. Mary Burnham outlined the use of new insecticides in the home. And Dr. Raymond W. Miller in Chicago reviewed the annual meeting of the American Institute of Cooperation. This is Ted Lingo speaking from the studios of WTOP in Washington. And this is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.